Good morning to all of you in the courtroom and at home. We're here for what would appear to be the final day of this test case in the omnibus autism proceeding. And last night before we concluded, the government ended its case in chief. And I understand, Ms. Chin Kaplan, that you want to call Mrs. Cedillo back to the stand for rebuttal testimony. Mrs. Cedillo, would you please take the stand? I think it would be probably a good idea.
Okay,
we want make you can have a go have a seat. That's okay. Go ahead and put your microphone on first, and I'll swear you in. Okay. All right, will you raise your right hand for me? Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give us will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Chin Kaplan, please go ahead.
Thank you, Special Master. Mrs. Cedillo, I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about Michelle when she was younger. Did she babble at some point in her adult life?
Yes, she did. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Michelle was about 9 months old, and Jennifer would come over, and Michelle loved Jennifer, my niece, so they would have their own little conversation with the little baby babble back and forth, and but she had already been doing that for several months.
And at some point in time, did she begin to acquire words?
Yes, she did.
Could you tell the court what words she had?
Yes, she was very small when... between the 7 and 9 month old range, where I would hold her on the bathroom sink, and she could see herself, her reflection in the vanity mirror, and I'd say, "Where's the baby? There's the baby." And so she touched the mirror and say, "Baby, baby." She continued to develop words. She would say a kiki for our kitties when she'd see we had some cats that would come by. We'd feed them outside, and we had a big picture window in the front. So she would stand at the window and say, "Kiki, kiki." She'd touch on the big window on the glass. When the children were walking to school, we live very close to two schools. One of them is a grade school, so when the children would be walking to school in the morning, she'd bang on the window and go, "Aye, aye, aye," so they could hear her, but of course they couldn't. Let's see, when my mom would come over every morning, almost every morning, she'd pick her up and hold her up to the crucifix, and she'd say, "Who's that? Who's that?" And she'd touch it, and then she'd say, "That's Jesus." And so then eventually when my mom would say, "Who's that?" she'd say, "Jesus." And when my husband would go to work, she'd hold her hand up this way, and she'd go, Bebe Addy. She used to love to eat apple, so when I was slicing apple, she'd see me and apple, and then I'd give her the apple, and then she quit saying apple. So
by the time she was about 1 year old, she was saying all these things?
Oh, yes.
And she was communicating all these things to you?
Yes.
And did she do it on a repeated basis?
Yes, she did.
And did you read to her at night?
Yes, we did. My husband and I both read to her about almost every single night.
And when you read to her, what did Michelle do?
She had her favorite books, and she would point to the characters on the pages. They were the baby board books. So if it was Mickey Mouse, or if it was the babies, there were some that ended, 10 babies, and she'd point to the babies, to the characters and the figures in the book.
So when you said the word, she would pick up the individual characters in the book and point to them?
Yes.
And We saw a lot of Sesame Street on the videos.
Yes.
Was there a reason you were filming Sesame Street so often?
Yes. If you'll notice when you review the video, the segments that were recorded, there are many segments of just the Sesame Street, but if you notice, it's just the opening song. And the reason for that is because, well, two, one is Michelle loved Sesame Street and the characters on it, and she was starting to say Big Bird, or trying in baby talk to say Big Bird. So it sounded so cute. We were trying, we repeatedly recorded that opening scene so we could try and capture her on the video saying Big Bird. I think towards the end there we got pretty close to one of them, but she would get very excited and happy with the opening song.
Was that one of the words that she had, Big Bird?
Big Bird and Bert, both.
Now, when she heard the music, did she do anything?
Oh, yes. My mom and dad were always telling her, dance, Michelle, dance to the music. And she would respond to dancing with her hands and feet. You know, if she was sitting, she'd move her hands and feet, yes.
And we noticed that your father used to play mute harmonica to her.
Yes.
And there was a scene that says, what does Grampy do? What was that about?
Oh, yes. That's in the 12/17/95 video. I asked her, what does Grampy do? Because that is what he would tell her. And she went, like that, because he would show her the harmonica. This is what Grampy does, you know, to blow into the harmonica. So she was imitating, you know, Michelle was associating my father's, you know, Grampy with the harmonica, with how he had taught her to do that sound.
Now, there was a scene in one of the videos where Dr. Fong indicated that Michelle was demonstrating hand regard.
Yes.
Do you know what hand regard is?
Yes, I do.
Could you just describe the scene that Dr. Fong was referring to?
Okay, it was the 12/17/95 video where she's in the ball pit, he's referring to where she pulls her hand back to look at it. But what you were probably not aware is that my mom, her grandmother, had been teaching her to blow kisses. So, of course, when babies blow kisses, you know, she's just doing that. That's the motion she was doing. So I asked her, where's Grammy? What's Grammy do? I think I said, where's Grammy? So Michelle went to blow her kisses because that's what my mom had been showing her to do. But Michelle was also teething, so her whole chin was full of saliva. So when she put her hand against her mouth and pulled it away, her hand was all wet. She held it up to look at the saliva.
I'd like to show you some photos. Mm-hmm. Just describe to the court when this photo was taken.
Okay, that was taken when Michelle was approximately 3 months and maybe 1.5 weeks, almost 2 weeks old. It was her first Christmas portrait.
Is she smiling?
Yes, she is.
And this was her first official photograph, is that it?
First official portrait, I guess. She might have had one the day she was born, you know, when the photographer at the hospital comes in.
Can you tell the court when this photo was taken?
She was probably between
6 to 7, 6 to 8 months
range, and she was playing with a pumpkin and some little Halloween characters that we had bought her. And I put a hat on her head, even though I wasn't going to wear it, but I just thought it was a cute picture.
And when was this photo taken?
That was taken in November of 1995, so she would have been 14 months old. That's about 1 month prior to the MMR vaccination.
And this photo?
That photo was taken July 25th of 2003. That was 1 day prior to her being hospitalized for 18 days. At that point, she was very sick with malnutrition. She had a bleeding disorder from the malnutrition. She had been self-abusing very severely. She was in a lot of abdominal and other pain at this point. She had uveitis. You can see the redness around her eyes, but we didn't know it at the time, what it was. She needed a lot of medical care at this point. She did not have a feeding tube, but did get a feeding tube through surgery placed while she was in the hospital during that stay. Yes.
Is pretty much how it's
trained. Yes, it is.
Just one last question. How has Michelle's illness affected your lives?
It has greatly affected our lives. Michelle was healthy and well and happy. She got the MMR, she got the fever, and became very, very sick. It has been a long 10 or 10 and a half years since she became sick, trying to find out what has happened to her and also trying to get the care that she needs. Her illness, subsequent illness, has not only affected Michelle, but it's affected our entire family. As you can see, we have quite a bit of family support, which I'm eternally grateful for. But it has affected everyone. My parents have spent their retirement helping us to care for Michelle. My husband doesn't take vacation anymore. All his time off is usually for driving to appointments. And actually, we, you know, on a bigger scale, we don't even take vacations with Michelle because it's too unpleasant for her, or she's too sick, or she's just having a very bad time. And her childhood, and you know, now she'll be 13. She'll be a teenager in just a couple of months. And her young childhood was spent, instead of at the fun places that, you know, the times you enjoy with your child, they were spent at doctors or offices or hospitals or getting very unpleasant procedures done. I cannot emphasize enough how much suffering Michelle has endured. And she is a very sick child. She has such an enormous will to live and to go on. And she has given us all a lot of strength, and she has taught us all a lot about life and about living and about trying and to keep trying. And you know, it has been all encompassing.
Are you done? Okay. No question. Mrs. Cedillo, thank you very much again for all your testimony.
Oh, thank you.
You may be excused.
For the record, I just need to state also, my family and all of us, we admire and want to thank you for the great respect you have shown, all of you have shown all of us during this time.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Cedillo. We are very grateful for you folks coming here and bringing Michelle to meet us, and we greatly appreciate your testimony and your participation throughout this.
Thank you.
So. So I assume that concludes the petitioner's rebuttal case.
It does, Mr.
Nesbitt. All right. For those of you both in the courtroom at home, have watched a lot of trials on TV, you know that often at the end of a case, we have something called closing argument, which is when the attorneys for each side sort of summarize or recap the testimony for the jury or the judge and argue why, based on the testimony that's been heard throughout the case, their side should win. In complex civil cases, and this certainly is a complex civil case, that such cases that don't, where we don't have a jury, it's more common than closing argument is something we have post-trial briefs. So instead of trying to stand up and summarize all the testimony orally in an argument before a jury, in a case like this, the attorneys will take the transcript, take all the hundreds or thousands of exhibits and thousands of pages of records that are part of our record in this case, and make their argument based on that, do it in written form in briefs. The petitioners will file a brief, the respondent will file a reply brief, and the petitioners will get another chance to do a brief. In a case like this, that's a more efficient way of doing it because of the huge amount of documents and testimony in the record. The parties will certainly get a better chance to fully explain their view of the evidence by that means. So we're not going to have the type of closing arguments, full-scale closing arguments, summarizing all the evidence that you might have expected. However, the petitioner's counsel is asked to make a brief closing statement. We'll call it closing statement instead of closing argument. That is addressed more to the public listening or the families listening to the case or here in the courtroom, more sort of summarizing, giving a sort of a closing summary to them. I stress it, it's not intended to fully summarize all the evidence of the case. Ms. Chin Kaplan and her co-attorneys will do that in a written brief. She's just going to give a brief statement at this point. So with that, Ms. Chin Kaplan, why don't you go ahead? Mr. Powers is going to do it. I'm sorry. Mr. Powers, come on. Come on up. Do we have a clip microphone for you? I know during the opening, some of the people at home that went. How about the one over there? During the opening statements, I know that some of the people at home had trouble hearing. So since we're doing this for their benefit, in large part, we want to make sure that they hear. So please go ahead, sir, when you're ready.
Thank you, Special Masters, and thank you for the opportunity to give a closing statement here, and thank you for unburdening us of having to attempt to summarize all of the evidence and to try to do it in about 20 minutes. That simply couldn't happen. But it is important to summarize the case for you all, sort of all of us who have been here, to sort of get our heads above the clouds of the evidence and really just walk through what we've heard and convey that message to the folks who are participating or attending telephonically or via the web or transcripts or however. The evidence summarized very, very briefly is straightforward, that you have a case here that is a test case for the theory, the general theory, that the combination of exposure to thimerosal-containing vaccines with a significant dose of ethyl mercury early in a child's life, combined then with MMR, can result in a complex system response that presents symptoms that get diagnosed as autism, and in particular, a suppressed immune system from the thimerosal in the vaccines. The introduction of the attenuated live measles virus then persists, and the persistence of that virus leading to a complex biological process of disease and a wide range of symptoms from gastrointestinal symptoms to neurodevelopmental and neurological symptoms that in Michelle's case have been diagnosed as autism. And that's the evidence that you've heard from toxicologists, immunologists. You've heard virology testimony, gastroenterologist, and pediatric neurologist, all describing the evidence and presenting the evidence to you. You've heard, in sum, a medical theory that links the exposures together, a medical theory that links the vaccines and the vaccine component thimerosal to the injury. You've heard a logical sequence of cause and effect, not just in the timing of the vaccines and the occurrence of the injury, but the timing of the biological processes within Michelle, and you'll see in other cases, in other children. So it's a logical sequence of cause and effect. And there is the temporal relationship, the timing relationship between the exposures and the occurrence of the injury. All of this has been supported by the evidence. All of this is biologically plausible, and we posit that more likely than not, in Michelle's case, the petitioner's evidence describes what happened. It describes causation, and it describes it in a way that meets the burden of proof in this program. And one thing you don't need to be reminded of, but perhaps folks who are listening in, the standard is not scientific certainty. It is not scientific certainty. And we certainly concede, as we did in our opening, and as we have all along, that there is debate on the science. There's a lot of debate. There's been over 2 weeks of debate in this room on the science. But the burden isn't certainty. It's more likely than not. And that burden has been satisfied. We've heard from an army of experts from both sides, but particularly from respondent side, a huge amount of evidence arguing that this just couldn't be. But when you sort through all of that evidence, there's really no other cause that is positive, that is viable. This is the more likely cause. I mean, you've heard everything from genetics, but nobody's been able to associate a single gene with a single symptom. You've heard epidemiology that, well, doesn't actually fit the facts of this case. And I could go on and on, but those are the type of evidence that you've heard. Despite the quantity of that evidence, qualitatively doesn't add up to defeating the petitioner's case here. And this is a comment that is directed more, and I'll be frank about it, is directed more completely to people outside this room, and particularly those in the news media. I've been following the press coverage, and as you all might have seen too, Special Masters, there has been press coverage here. One of the messages that I have picked up in the media is really sort of castigating the Cedillo family and other petitioners for even attempting to get compensation in this program, saying that if they get compensation, then they're going to drive people away from vaccines, and it's therefore an anti-vaccine message. But for those folks who have been promulgating that message outside the building, you have to listen to what's going on inside the building, and there has not been a single witness on petitioner's side of the case saying that vaccines are bad, that we should stop using vaccines, that the measles vaccine shouldn't be used, that the MMR vaccine shouldn't be used. There has not been a single bit of anti-vaccine evidence in the room, and it can't support an argument outside the room that this family or the other families who are in the program are out to hurt vaccine programs, vaccine coverage, and certainly have no interest in doing anything that could be interpreted as opening the doors to infectious diseases. As we talked about in the opening, this case is about trust. The trust that the Cedillos and the other families had in the safety of the immunization program that they and their children participated in. They trusted that program, and they unfortunately are among the rare, fortunately it's a rare number of children, but unfortunately for those people who fall into that rare group, this is where they need to be. So they trusted the vaccine program, and they now are trusting you all here in the Court of Claims to adjudicate their claims fairly. It is about the social compact, and it is about trust, and again, to those outside the room, the family should not be disparaged because they are doing what Congress has said they need to do if they think they were injured by coming here. They're living up, and they have lived up, to their end of the social compact. And on the issue of trust in the social compact, Mrs. Cedillo said it better than I could say it. In terms of what's happened in this case, the care, the attention, the resources that you special masters and the program have put into hearing this case and to setting up the omnibus proceeding to decide all these other cases is certainly appreciated and respected. This hearing has been as open and transparent as anybody could hope, and that is a huge step forward for the families that are looking for justice in the program. Because again, all of those families, regardless of the outcome, simply need to know that their trust in getting shots, their trust in following Congress's direction and coming here, will be reciprocated with fairness, with equity, and with an open mind to hear the evidence and weigh the evidence under the appropriate standard. And as I said, in this particular case, the evidence does support, under the standards that are applicable in the program, a finding for the petitioners, and then to use that decision to move forward to resolve other test cases and ultimately to resolve large numbers of cases that are waiting decisions in the omnibus proceeding. So again, thank you for the indulgence, so to speak, of having a few minutes here to close. We absolutely will be submitting post-hearing briefs, and we look forward to speaking with you again in the next test case, and in probably many more to come over the course of the next 9 to 12 months. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. And we note that while you were speaking, Michelle, who started the hearing with us here, has come back into the room with her father, and I'll speak to them in a minute, but thank you very much for your comments. Mr. Matanosky, did you want to make any kind of a closing statement?
Yes, sir, I did.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity. You know from our off-the-record comments that I did not favor making a closing statement here, knowing that there's closing briefs. I know that you would prefer this to be brief, and I'm going to try to do that, but unfortunately I think it'll be a little bit longer, in fact, much longer than what Mr. Powers had to say. I wouldn't apologize. I would otherwise apologize, but because of the importance of the issue here, and because I now have to come up here to explain the government's position and explain our view of the case, I won't apologize for taking that time, because it's important here that you, it's important to this case that you hear this. What you haven't heard so far from the petitioners, not in their case, not in their closing argument here, is whether or not what they've offered is good science for supporting their theory. Now, Daubert requires that. You didn't hear that in Mr. Powers' closing statement. He jumped right ahead to the burden of proof. He missed the important critical factor that goes into what you can consider as far as it goes to that burden of proof. And there's a reason for that, and that is because the petitioner's case does not rest on good science. It rests on junk science. It rests on the science that is supposed to be left outside that courtroom door, that's not supposed to come in for your consideration at all. It's not legitimate. It's not reliable. There's no studies. There's no textbooks. There's no literature. And there's no reliable, legitimate testing behind what they've offered. We've shown each component of the PSC case to be inconsistent with the norms of good science. It's speculative, it's untested, and at the most critical junctures, it's contradicted by known fact. Now, I understand this is a bench trial, and there's a difference between a bench trial and a jury trial, but the Daubert standards still apply. Those standards must be applied even in a bench trial to determine whether or not you consider the evidence. Now, there's a motivation behind the PSC to jump ahead to the burden of proof. They want you to turn a blind eye on whether the evidence they've offered is reliable. They want you to turn a blind eye on whether the evidence they've offered comports with the accepted standards of science, even though they are offering it as scientific evidence. They've alleged that what the respondent is requiring is scientific certainty as far as evidence. That's not what this, what's at issue here isn't what the respondent is requiring. It's what the law requires. And the law doesn't require scientific certainty. Daubert doesn't require scientific certainty, but it certainly requires science, good science, not junk science. What you've been offered is a series of fanciful notions that are backed up only by the fact that someone who's offered them has a couple of letters after their name, MD or PhD. That does not make it good science. PSC wants to hide from that close scrutiny of the case. They don't want bright light shining on their evidence. They don't want that bright light shining on the review of their evidence. They want to jump ahead to the burden of proof and argue it's just more likely than not. That's the same standard that was applied in Daubert. It's the same standard that's applied in every civil case. More likely than not. That's nothing new. It's no lower standard here. It's the same standard. What we're discussing is whether or not they have the evidence that can even be considered for that standard. Unigenetics is a perfect example of that. If you were to determine it was reliable testing that was done by Unigenetics, then it comes in, and you can consider it as far as it goes to whether they've met their burden of proof. If, however, you take the initial step of deciding whether or not it's reliable and decide that it's not reliable, as we think we've demonstrated, then it's not available to consider about whether they've met their burden of proof. In sum, Daubert says, check your junk science at the door. It's not coming in the courtroom. Then, and only then, do we go to the burden of proof and decide whether or not the petitioners have met the burden of proof. Now, I'm going to be as charitable as I can be about the petitioner's case here, the PSC case. It's, at best, speculation, idle speculation. Now, at worst, it's a contrivance. It's a contrivance that's been developed and articulated and promoted by its chief proponent, and that's Andrew Wakefield. And he promoted it for financial gain. Either way, it's not science. Now, I'm going to turn a moment to test case. I think one thing that's been abundantly clear over the past 3 weeks, we cannot do this in 4,800 cases. We cannot do 3-week trials in 4,800 cases. So I'm going to offer to you this plea. Go beyond the specific facts of this case. Do not rest on those specific facts. Make application of your decision to the broader issues that are involved here, whether or not MMR causes autistic spectrum disorder. PSC offered this as a test case. Treat it as such. Hold them to that. Go beyond the specific facts. We believe we've shown that Michelle Cedillo suffers from autism. She suffered from it before she ever got an MMR vaccine. Do not stop at that finding. Go forward and find on each and every factor particular to their theory of the case. There's a reason to do that specific to this case. There's contingencies, obviously, that an appellate court may disagree with you on a particular factual finding, and you'll want those other findings to be there to support whatever finding you have overall in the case. There's also a reason for all these future cases so that we're not here doing 3-week trials again and again. That's to offer guidance on how those cases will be decided in front of you, how those remaining 4,800 cases will be decided. And as you recall, the petitioner's steering committee said that this theory affects a significant number of cases. In fact, they offered, or one firm offered, that it's 80% of their 1,200 cases rise or fall on this theory. You need to find whether or not the inflammation, whether or not Michelle Cedillo's autism occurred before her vaccine. You need to find whether the PSC has proven that autistic spectrum disorders can be caused by MMR. Whether or not there's inflammation in Michelle Cedillo's bowel or intestines, you need to find whether or not MMR can cause autistic spectrum disorders. Whether or not they recover measles virus from Michelle Cedillo's bowel biopsy, you need to make a finding on whether or not MMR causes autistic spectrum disorder. Now, I know I've mentioned several times in the course of these proceedings Andrew Wakefield, his theory. And there's a reason for that. And that's because all the strands through these cases come back to him. He presented bad science. And I'm going to run through the chronology again because it's important. The chronology of how this arose and how it was promoted. In 1996, Andrew Harris, a firm of solicitors in Great Britain, approached Andrew Wakefield and asked him to consult with them in cases involving MMR, allegations of MMR causing autism. Andrew Wakefield was paid £55,000 for his efforts at that point. Andrew Wakefield in 1997 took out a patent for a monovalent measles vaccine. In 1998, he published the paper that's caused the stir that we've now seen reinterpreted, rearticulated a number of times until more than 10 years later, we have it in our courtroom today. He did not reveal at the time that he published that paper that he had this financial interest. He did not reveal that several of his patients in that paper were in fact litigants in the MMR litigation. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield approached John O'Leary and consulted with him. John O'Leary went on to set up Unigenetics, a company of which he's the director, was the director and shareholder. Unigenetics' purpose was to test samples for the UK MMR litigation. Now, you've heard testimony about the reliability of that testing. You've seen the papers that have come out of that lab. Those papers, in fact, the Ullman paper that was discussed here at length and relied on so heavily by the petitioners, the patients, some of the patients at least, in that case study were MMR litigants. There's a direct connection between that litigation and our litigation here. That litigation folded, Unigenetics went away. But we have it back here now in this case. Folded in 2004 after the whistle was blown on Andrew Wakefield and it was revealed his substantial financial connections with ongoing litigation. Now, I'm going to try to go through, I had more lengthy in the sense of brevity, I'm not going to go through a long recitation of the evidence that's before you. The PSC evidence, well, it certainly doesn't meet Daubert. Now, I want to step aside for a moment. Just saying that you're not anti-vaccine doesn't give you a pass on proving your good science. Just saying that we're not anti-vaccine and none of our experts are doesn't give you a pass on proving that you have reliable, legitimate evidence backing up your theory. It was interesting that the very next sentence after saying we're not anti-vaccine that Mr. Powers made was about safety. That is implicated in this case. Nothing that the petitioner's steering committee experts have offered is legitimate, but all of what they're saying goes to whether or not the vaccine is safe. Dr. Apashian, Dr. Kriegsman, Dr. Kennedy, Dr. Hefner, all of what they're saying is going to this. Dr. Byers, Dr. Kinsberg, it's all going to whether this vaccine is safe or not. That's at issue here. At key points, their evidence is just flat out wrong, and I think we've shown that. At key points, Dr. Kinsborn, for example, he was their key witness. He said, in the course of 3 pages of the transcript, I don't know that for a fact. I have no idea. Well, it's resident in the lymphatic tissue and maybe elsewhere, but I don't know that. I don't know whether it's the same or different process. I don't know. Those were all answers in the course of pages in the transcript, 1134 to 1136, answers to questions about their theory. How can that make the standard of reliable evidence? Their key experts, Dr. Byers and Dr. Kinsborn, make a living of testifying. That's their job. This courtroom is their place of business. It's not the lab, it's not the university, it's not the hospital. Now, petitioners want to skip ahead to the burden of proof, and this is a secondary argument for the respondent. You only get there if that evidence that they offered has come through the courtroom door, if it is good, reliable evidence. It is not. But I'm going to address the secondary argument here, the burden of proof. I just want it to be absolutely clear. We're only there if that evidence is reliable. The burden of proof considers the type and quantum of evidence. You have to consider that before you get to that, whether they've met their burden. If they've offered scientific evidence, it has to be qualified as such. They haven't here, but they also don't meet their burden. Their burden is to show a temporal association. Do you have one? Could Dr. Kinsborn offer one here? He could not. On critical points, he said, I don't know, on temporal association. Dr. Apashian, he had no idea how long immunosuppression would last. Where's the temporal association for the immunosuppression? He offered no testimony on it. Obviously, the onset of the disease has to be consistent with the temporal association. You haven't established one, then you can't meet that part of the burden. They've never shown that their theoretical mechanism can occur in nature. They've offered you possibles, maybes, might. Where is the evidence that it occurs in nature? There's been a consistent theme in the PSC's case. It's a consistent theme about their burden here. And it isn't that they have to make more likely than not. And though they pay lip service to that, it isn't that they have to make more likely than not. It's that they have to show it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I will cite to you some articles that throw out this possibility. And unless the government can prove that it's impossible, I meet my burden of proof. That's what's been offered to you. And it's ironic that at this point, that's when the PSC wants scientific certainty. When it's the government that's coming in and offering evidence that may contradict the possibilities that they've offered, they want scientific certainty. Mr. Power's cross-examination of Dr. Fombone yesterday is a prime example of this. Now, the PSC's claimed that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause immunosuppression. They've never offered any reliable support on that. But when Dr. Fombone came on the stand to talk about epidemiological studies that showed no association between thimerosal-containing vaccines and autism, the PSC was quick to jump on Dr. Fombone about dose. Now, where did dose figure into their case before? Did Dr. Apashian give you any idea of what the importance of dose was? He gave you a chart. He didn't say, well, at this dose, immunosuppression occurs, and lower, it doesn't. This is the critical dose. This is the amount that's necessary to cause the effect, and this is how long the effect will last. Dose never played into that. But when Dr. Fombone is offering the epidemiological evidence, Mr. Powers jumps on him and says, that study from Denmark had a different dose than is involved here. As it turns out, that dose in Denmark is 125 micrograms, whereas here it's 137.5. Throw out a study that looks at the entire population of children in Denmark because of 12.5 micrograms of ethyl mercury. Do you have any evidence upon which to base that? Have they offered any evidence of how that amount is critical to their case? That difference is somehow important or significant? You heard Dr. Oldstone's article mentioned time and time again. What does that article show? Possibility, at best, about persistent virus? It's an article that's talking about LCM virus, a virus of mice. It's not talking about measles virus. Again, it's a possibility, and our experts are confronted with this. Doesn't this article say persistent virus can cause unusual disease? An article about LCM virus in mice? If we can't disprove that, apparently the PSC believes it's met its burden. Now, I'm going to spend a little time on this, and I do beg indulgence on this, but I think...
Well, Mr. Manasky, I thought we had a 20-minute limit on this. So make sure you conclude within that limit. I think you're at 17.
Well, sir, I didn't realize. I wish I had had the little lights here on the stand to let me know that I was going to cover the new evidence that was submitted yesterday.
Well,
I thought that would prevent the us from, or would obviate the need for us to have to come in with another expert report in this case because this new evidence.
Why don't you go ahead and address that new evidence?
Thank you, sir. This was offered yesterday. It's an editorial. It had the prestigious sounding name that it's the USA World SSPE Registry. You aren't going to find that anywhere if you look for it. Apparently, this is Dr. Dykin's own creation. If you want to contact him, you don't go to .edu, you don't go to .gov, you go to AOL.com. This is in a non-index journal. And the interesting thing about it, I'm going to cut my comments about this short, too. He says it's a newly described condition that he calls, interestingly, I-M-N-E, mine. And he says it's something that he calls. He's the first to describe it. If you look through it, he talks about they've actually now, according to him, found wild measles. They've identified measles virus in the CSF samples of patients, and identified it to be vaccine strain. Now this came out in 2004. Look at the references in this paper, this editorial, this editorial that appears in the non-index journal. They go back to Andrew Wakefield. The patients that he looked at apparently were from the litigation. The cases that he talked about, he referred to Alexander Harris. This never has been shown by anybody else, never repeated, doesn't appear in an index journal. This is the same stuff we were dealing with Dr. Bradstreet. I don't believe we even have to address this any further. There's a mistake in the very first line. It says that SSPE occurs in immunocompromised individuals, and that's not true. You've already heard evidence on that. I'm wrapping up, sir. I didn't want to talk about credibility just briefly. Ask yourselves on the credibility of witnesses, where they're coming from. Is their place of business the hospital, or is it the courtroom? Do they get paid to testify, or do they testify to get paid? Now, measles virus is a killing disease. That's been made abundantly clear by the testimony you've heard. There's no doubt that autism 2 is a devastating disease. And you'd have to be made of stone not to feel sympathy, compassion, and profound respect for the families that have to deal with that every day of their lives and for the individuals who are afflicted with the disease. Nevertheless, that doesn't give you a pass on having good science to support an accusation that an important part of the public health, or important weapon by public health in eliminating measles virus, is still available to do that important work across the world, around the world. Now, I've been talking, unfortunately, for a long time. I know that. In 30 minutes or so of argument back here, back and forth here, in that 30 minutes, 26 children died of measles virus. That's what's at stake as well in this proceeding. You need to rely on good science before you make your decision in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Powers?
Special Master, by my count, I used 12 of the 20 minutes. I'm not even proposing to use the remaining 8 minutes, but
go ahead.
If we could have a couple of minutes to wrap up.
Go ahead, please.
Just a couple of points to address that Mr. Matanoski raised. The first one is on the reliability of evidence and the reliability of science. Just want to emphasize that what you're looking at when you're making that assessment is methodology. Clearly, clearly the experts disagree on either side of the case about the conclusions to be drawn. Their opinions clash. Their interpretation of the evidence is dramatically different from one side to the other. But Daubert and any other standard of evidence isn't about the outcomes and the opinions. It's about the methodology. And when you look at the methodology that the experts in petitioner's case have relied on, the methodology is sound, and it is not junk, and it is reliable, and the methodology has generated evidence that meets the burden of proof in the program. So that's the first point, that when we're talking about reliability, it's methodology, not the opinions generated, that you should be assessing. The opinions then obviously come in when you're weighing the evidence, once you've decided that you're considering the evidence. Second point to raise is that this is a program that's set up for a lot of reasons, but one of them is to avoid civil litigation. And so when we hear the horror stories about measles, the MMR, the measles vaccine being removed from the market, I believe one of the reasons that the families are here is that the claims get resolved here so that these folks don't end up in the civil system and don't start raising all of those issues about threats to the vaccine supply. This is the place to decide them, and you all know what the standards to apply to that decision are. And then the final point I want to make is what this case is about, and it is not about Andy Wakefield. It's not. It's about Michelle Cedillo. It's about 4,800 families looking for justice. It's about the trust those families have, and to hear a government's case that is based on a smear campaign, a character assassination campaign, hearsay, innuendo, traveling around the world, collecting information, using government resources to build a smear campaign about somebody who's not a party, who's not a witness, who's not offering evidence, is outrageous. It's not about Andy Wakefield. It's about the Cedillos. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I want to make a very few brief comments before we adjourn. First, on the immediate point about the closing arguments, again, I stress that to talk about all the evidence, to summarize all the evidence of this that we have before us here would be hard for anyone. Be really almost an impossible task. So that's why we are going to have briefs. The full comments that both parties want to make about summarizing the evidence, arguing their case, they're going to be able to do that. The briefs can be as long as they want, and they're going to get a full chance to do that, take their time, do it fully and completely. And if I wasn't clear about we were going to propose no closing statements. The petitioners asked to make a closing statement just to sort of wrap things up for the people listening in. We agreed to that. I think maybe I was not as clear as I should have been in talking about the time limits on that. But I think we got a flavor for both sides here, and we're going to get more than a flavor. We're going to get the full explanation in the closing briefs. And I also say to counsel, we will also, sometime later this week, we'll call up and we'll set up another status conference for discussing the timing of the briefs and any other post-trial procedures we need to. A few more comments, and then we'll be done here. First, we again want to thank the Cedillo family for coming to Washington, for being and staying with us throughout this very long hearing. We thank you folks for generously agreeing to have Michelle's case designated as the first test case in the omnibus proceeding. And again, as on behalf of myself and my colleagues, as we said at the beginning of the hearing, we extend our sympathy for all you've been through, as you described in the witness stand today, for all Michelle has been through. I'm glad that we got to see and meet Michelle at the beginning of the case, and that she was here again briefly with us this morning for the end of it. we're trying to appreciate what you've been through. And again, we also say that we are tremendously admire the way that your family, your whole family, and not just Mr. and Mrs. Cedillo, but we've met a number of members of the family, the way the whole family has rallied around her and done such a wonderful job taking care of her. So again, Mr. and Mrs. Cedillo and other family members, thank you again. We also wish to thank the counsel for both sides who've really done such a wonderful job presenting the evidence to us. We appreciate how hard you've worked over the last few months to get ready for this, and the hours you put in just in the last 3 weeks to actually present the case. I want to thank the expert witnesses as well who appeared before us. We want to thank again the judges of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit who allowed us to use their courtroom. And we want to especially thank all the employees of our court and the Court of Appeals who have done such a great job assisting us in preparing for this hearing and conducting it. We have a tremendous debt of gratitude to them. Next, I want to acknowledge again the other people who are also very important to this proceeding, and that, of course, is the families of the other 5,000 Vaccine Act claimants who've been diagnosed with autism or similar conditions. Some members of those families have been with us in the courtroom at various times. Some have been listening in via our telephone conferencing system, and others have followed the hearing by downloading the audio or reading the transcripts on our website. To all the family members who've listened and those who haven't, and to the Cedillo family, all three of us pledge to you again that we will consider very, very carefully the evidence that's been put before us, and we will give that evidence a complete and thorough study. We realize the great importance of the task assigned to us in deciding these cases, and we will give our greatest effort in carrying out that responsibility. And then finally, now that this hearing is finished, some of you may want to know, when will we hear the decision? There are really two answers to that. First, as to the specific case of Michelle Cedillo, as I noted before, under the Vaccine Act statute, responsibility for a single case is assigned to a single special master. So I myself will consider the specific evidence to the Cedillo's case and make and issue a written ruling in this case. But as you heard a few minutes ago, first both parties are going to file written briefs. That process, realistically, with the huge record we have here, thousands and thousands of pages of evidence and beyond the rereading the transcript of here, obviously that briefing process will take several months. Once that briefing process is continued, I will issue a written ruling as soon as I can thereafter. The second part of the question, of course, deals with the fact that this hearing we've had for the last 2.5 weeks is about more than just Michelle Cedillo's case. As I explained on the opening day of the hearing, Michelle's case is just one of an initial group of three test cases to be decided in the omnibus autism proceeding. So during the past 3 weeks, the parties for both sides have presented evidence not just about the particulars of Michelle's case, but also about the general causation theory, the first general causation theory of the petitioner steering committee. That is the general theory that MMR vaccines and thimerosal-containing vaccines can combine to cause autism. Having heard that general causation testimony during this hearing, my two fellow special masters will undertake the process of applying that evidence to the other two initial test cases. They will be conducting evidentiary hearings concerning those two test cases this fall. Those evidentiary hearings will be much more limited in scope than this hearing, hopefully, because as I previously stated, the testimony we heard today or over the last 2.5 weeks on the general causation issue will be also available to be applied to those test cases. So once those hearings are conducted, Special Master Campbell Smith will issue a written ruling in the particular test case that assigned to her, and then and Special Master Vowell will be issuing her written ruling in the test case assigned to her. So for updates concerning this case, the Cedillo case, and the other two test cases, and for the general progress of the omnibus autism proceeding and the additional general causation theories that are yet to come, I would say keep checking the autism proceeding page on this court's internet website. That's where we'll continue to post the information about all it. With that, I thank everyone again for being here. We are now adjourned.